Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Indie Football Podcast. In the absence of editor, leader, legend Ed Mallion, I'm your host today, Jack Pitbrook. I'm joined by our chief football writer, Miguel Delaney. Hello, Miguel.
Hello.
Chief sports writer, Jonathan Liu. Hello,
hi,
Jonathan.
Hi.
And we're pleased to bring today's big guest, Tony Evans, former football editor of The Times, now a freelance writer and author, with a new book out. Hi, Tony.
Ah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks a lot. So first, we're going to start with Old Trafford.
Yeah.
We all know what happened. If you're listening to the podcast, you'll definitely have seen the goals. Miguel, was this a big vindication for Jose Mourinho?
I'm not sure I'd go that far. I mean, I think basically it brought out what still remains best in Mourinho. I think it he spotted the weakness in the other team, got his team to rootly exploit them. And United defended quite well. I think Bailly made some difference to their back. I think that was actually pretty key, maybe in terms of United season and what's going to happen going forward as well, in the sense that that defence just... I mean, all Mourinho teams have been built on good defences, and that defence looks so much shakier when it's Smalling or and Jones there rather than Bailly, despite the own goal.
Would you say it was the best you've seen anyone try and stop Liverpool for a while?
Probably, yeah. And also, actually, I mean, we did a piece in October before the awful nil-all. It was finally United-Liverpool game, which something happened. I mean, I don't know what you think about this, Tony, but I mean, it's been so long since that match has actually had a bit of spark to it.
Oh, yeah, especially during Mourinho's tenure, because, you know, 2-0-0s and 1-1-1.
Yeah.
And he came to kill those games. This one, he had a plan to try and get forward as well, to try and score. I think it made a big difference. I thought it was quite a good performance from United, and I agree with you, Bailly's going to make a huge difference to them at the back. And I thought they set up really cleverly, and you know, using Mata in the role he used, I didn't think he would do.
Yeah,
and I didn't think Mata could do it.
Yeah, true. Although it's one thing as well about, I suppose, when a Mourinho team goes ahead, it kind of had license then to do what he really loves and stick two midfielders in front of the defence. I think it's been described as his travat.
The high pressure triangle.
Yeah, the high pressure triangle, yeah. But that was, I mean, from there, like United were.
And the thing as well he did, which is a really simple thing, and I don't understand why people don't do it to Liverpool more. I don't understand why they don't do it to City. Go long, drop the ball on the edge of the centre, especially Lovren, and see what happens.
Yeah, and his quotes after the game were telling Mourinho in that regard that Lukaku really fancied it on the day. He thought he had the beating of Lovren.
I'd fancy it, to be honest.
There's been a lot of discussion as well after the game about how, you know, Liverpool had so much possession and that, but only one team came to play. But, I mean, why would you play into Liverpool's hands?
Are we back into Brendan Rodgers' territory of pointless possession?
Yeah.
You know, it's possession with a purpose is the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, I only saw the highlights, but I think unless Manchester United created hatfuls of chances when the, you know, the highlights that weren't shown on the highlights, you know, they played like they had a very specific plan to stick it on the head of Lovren, and Lukaku was pretty destructive, I thought. And we saw once again that Mourinho gets quite a kick out of coming up with bespoke plans for these games, and especially against a team like Liverpool. I think he's always had a certain thing about beating Liverpool, and he is essentially
adjusted. And Klopp actually.
And Klopp, exactly. Yeah. So he adjusted. Klopp still has his principles, but United have the 3 points, so who really got the last laugh there?
Do you think this is a United performance that they can build on from into next year and beyond, or do you think it's just it's a one-off special plan?
Well, that's what the game felt like a little bit, because of the form going into the game, where the two teams were, because it was ultimately just a battle for second place, so it didn't mean that much in the greater scheme of things, but it almost felt like more important to what's going to happen next and going forward. And also, from about 3 weeks ago, where it looked like there were kind of problems at United again, the Pogba stuff, the game, and the Pogba stuff hasn't completely gone away. You know, he was genuinely injured the weekend, obviously, though. But, you know, the draw, it's a few game, how they played, even the first half against Palace. But now, three wins in a row, two of them against other top six sides. And I thought Saturday even, was the best performance of all three by a long way.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think reports of Mourinho's demise have been greatly exaggerated. You know, they are second in the league and they're still in the Champions League. They haven't been playing the greatest football, but, you know, they've done all right. They should be closer to City. And I thought, almost everyone he's bought since he arrived there has been huge strapping six-footers, and I thought they were going to physically bully the likes of City, and they haven't done that.
Yeah.
And they didn't even physically bully Liverpool, well, apart from Lukaku. But, you know, there's still a work in progress. But, you know, it's probably because we expect so much of Mourinho's sides.
Well, that's probably it. I mean, ultimately, this goes back to his peak. And I think, I mean, when you write something about Mourinho, or when we have discussions like this, the argument is always, oh, you're saying he's finished. I don't think he's finished at all. I would just say that his best qualities aren't necessarily the best qualities in football anymore, and he's been kind of taken over. But that's not to say he can still be usually effective, as a Saturday showed, basically.
Is it too early to say that this is a game? This game will help to define who are City's main challengers next season.
Probably, yeah. I think it depends on the summer. Although you saw that thing about Liverpool as well, in the sense that they're, you know, I think the Klopp era is very, obviously very positive. He's made progress, and the fact there's an excitement about every game is inherently a good thing as a supporter, but you just feel like you can't fully trust them.
Well, I mean, one of the things the game showed up was the weakness in midfield. Everyone talks about the goalkeeper and the defence and the full-backs, because it's all obvious. But, you know, that central midfield area is still a problem. Protecting those centre-halves is an issue, and he hasn't addressed that. When they're going forward, they're great. But, you know, the minute they start to backpedal and you get behind them, then they've got problems. And, you know, everyone points to the stats and say, oh, you know, they haven't conceded many goals this season. But you look at the goals they've conceded against top four sides. Any time they come up against a good team, they've, you know, they've struggled a little bit. And I think that's got to be an issue. Unless he strengthens that midfield, people think Chiesa's going to make a big difference. But he's another forward going player.
Hmm.
Do you think they need a new, better holding midfielder for next season?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, Emery Chan just isn't mobile enough for this division.
I think it's hard to separate the quality of the defence and from the tactics that Klopp has them playing. I mean, time and again, you see them defending on the back pedal, essentially. And even good players are going to struggle when they're when they're defending, running back towards their goal the whole time, as they are so often.
I think this is a really interesting issue with Klopp and Liverpool is, are the defensive problems in the team, are they a function of the individual players not being good enough, or is it because he's too open and too attacking? I don't really know what the answer is.
Well, you know what? My view is simple, that defence is the easiest position, has got the easiest positions to fill and to organise. You've just got to work on it on the training grounds. I think if you give Rafa Benitez, for example, and every Liverpool fan will start screaming because you can either like Klopp or you can like Benitez. It's ridiculous. But if you give Benitez this defence, they'll be well organised. Give them that midfield and they'll be well organised. Give them their attack and they won't score as many goals. It's as simple as that. But you know what? I mean, it goes back to Brendan Rodgers, and it goes back to beyond that. It goes back to the recruitment thing. I remember in 2014, when Rodgers was looking for a defender in January, I asked a very senior member at the club, I said, why aren't they looking for defenders? They were after Salah at the time. And he said, there are no defenders out there. There are no defenders out there. You know, it's, there are loads of defenders.
How much has the signing of Van Dijk improved Liverpool's defence?
He's a bit. Not enough for the money they paid. He's big, he's mobile, he's quick, he's a talker, which is the best thing, and an organiser, which, considering that it's an almost silent area, that, you know, the keeper doesn't talk. Well, Karius does a bit more, but Mignolet didn't, and there's not a great deal of communication. Again, that's one of those things where you need someone to drag those central midfielders back, to make sure the keeper's in position, to, you know, to make sure the full-backs don't push up too much. So he will improve them, but I think he's going to need a couple of players around him. And it's interesting that there's been quite a few sides targeting Trent Alexander-Arnold over the last few weeks, months. And, you know, the kid's got loads of potential, but he's not a natural fullback. He mightn't be a natural midfielder. He might fall in the gaps.
Can that be damaging to a young player when that happens, actually? I mean, I remember it with Kieran Gibbs, where he had two kind of horror displays against United in 08-09.
Champions League semi-final. Yeah, he went off at half-time in tears.
Yeah, obviously, there was a spell where he became kind of Arsenal's starting fullback. But do you think that can have any sort of long-term damage when it's that early in the career and that obviously...
Callum Chambers has never recovered from a really bad game he had against Jefferson Montero.
Yeah.
About towards the end of his first season at Arsenal.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm more or less certain that those young players never recovered from being coached by Arsene Wenger. but there's a bit of the same thing going on with Klopp there, you know. It's like, if you're an attacking player, you want to go to Klopp because you'll get it all out of you. If you're a defender, you know, might not be the best place for you.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Alexander-Arnold. I would take him over Gomez any day of the week. I think he's good. There's a lot to work with there. And... It doesn't necessarily have to be a big blow to him. He's clearly got done like a kipper by Rashford for the first goal. He's committed himself too early. Those are the things you would hope he learns with experience. Those are the sort of games that he learns from. And if you're looking for a manager who's going to kind of pump him up and keep his confidence high, then you know Klopp is the sort of guy who's going to do that.
Actually, on that point, and especially in relation to Mourinho and his status, I mean, it's like you're saying if you're an attacking player, you go to Klopp. If you're a defender, then... Is Mourinho still the one to get the best out? He probably is. Maybe Simeone. But you know you're going to grow. If you're a centre-half, you know you're going to grow on Mourinho side.
Yeah, yeah. And if Rafa was at a good club, you know, he'd be the same. But it's interesting about whether... sometimes games like this are a crossroads. I remember in 1978, I'm that old, 1978, it's ancient history to you lot. Hansen having a nightmare at Old Trafford was responsible for two goals. And, you know, he talks about it himself as being the game when he realised that he had to do more than just go out on the pitch and, you know, use his athleticism and use his ability to play football at the highest level. And he had to crack down and work even harder. So hopefully Alexander-Arnold will do that, have a think about himself and whether he's getting coached or not, say to himself, if I want to be a top player at this level, I've got to do these things.
Actually, there's a good piece in that. Atrocious games actually were the makings of players rather than the destruction of them.
I mean, it's the difference between playing a game and playing a match. And I think Mourinho teams play it as a match.
Can you unpack that a bit?
Yeah. I suppose this goes back to the old argument about process versus result, whereas I think Klopp teams... Pochettino teams, Wenger teams, they play the game as a sort of continuous process the game is merely a 90-minute snapshot. Whereas if you're playing in a Mourinho side, 0 to 90 minutes is really all that counts. That's your performance time. And so while you may not improve quite so much, you become a smarter match player in those sort of sides than you do playing in a team where it's all part of a... You know, an ongoing evolutionary process.
That's the most interesting, that's the best explanation or description I've ever heard of the phrase "winning football matches."
Yeah, I'd take it a stage further. I mean, for example, Juventus last week at Wembley. You know, they weren't in the game for sort of 60 minutes, and at the point where it looked as if they folded, they got niggly. Yeah. You know, they just disrupted everything, and Tottenham's attention just wandered just for a second, and boom, they're in there. You know, and there's a certain kind of beautiful cynicism about it, which I appreciate. Yeah. You know, I enjoy watching it, and Mourinho teams do that.
Well, even in relation to that issue, and it's always this old hat, quote unquote, your dad argument about having leaders in the team. But even recently, I remember Ian Wright telling me that basically, when he was in that Arsenal team, if a game was kind of tight or 1-0, Tony Adams just knew to send the call out, right, we all drop 10 yards, earn the win, lads, earn the win. And that makes a massive difference with teams in such situations.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the idea of leadership, and especially with young players like Alexander-Arnold, you know, he's obviously having a shocker there. He's apologised on Twitter. I mean, which tells me that no one said to him either during the game or after, you know, like, one, get your head right. Two, afterwards, don't worry about it. Learn from it. You know, don't brood on it. And you need someone with experience who's been there and who's been through the nightmare, who've lived the nightmare and can say to you, look, next time. And also, when you're under pressure, like Tony Adams, who was one of the best I've ever seen, Harry, who would say to everyone, hey, you, knuckle down, right, let's do it.
Yeah.
There seem to be so... From what Tony was saying, there's not many teams out there who play like that now. Like, even Manchester City don't...
Pep Hammer is a process.
Yeah, they don't manage games like that. Yeah. They play the same way all the time. But fortunately for them, they're so good that they never have to change and they can always end up winning. But
yeah.
It seems like lots of other teams short of City try and play like them, fall in the gap.
Yeah. But even now, this might be just a line Guardiola has, but even when he was asked recently about kind of breaking records this season, hitting 100 points or whatever, and he just sort of dismisses all that. No, we just keep doing what we do. Whereas I think... Would other managers really actually chase the defeat? Well, I mean, Wenger definitely chased the unbeaten record.
Mm. I mean, I think that one of the problems that Guardiola will have at some point, you know, we've seen it with loads of teams over the years, they're way ahead of everyone for a year, maybe two, and then everyone works out what they do and catches up.
Mm.
And unless they've got a change up in the process, then they get caught.
Yeah.
Do you think that will happen in City next season?
I think there's a fair chance of it, yeah. I think everyone will have seen what they do and will be looking. I think everyone will be looking at the high press and say, you know, let's not try and play out against them. But people are still trying to play out against them. It's madness. People will be hoofing the ball long, you know, there'll be a lot of route one going on. Try and get into that midfield area, you know, where they want, when they've got the front four committed, and I think that they will catch them. It always happens.
It is amazing though how late teams seem to cotton on to that. I remember it was actually a big discussion in the Leicester season as well, where it was only until the last four or five games of the season and it was eventually won when people realised, hang on, why are we shouldn't go out against the team because we're just playing into their hands. And but the damage is already done to the campaign.
And the Conte season, last season.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Is that ego on the part of managers? And we're going to be the ones to burst their bubble.
Managers are very stubborn when it comes to things like this.
Yeah.
They're not malleable to circumstances in the way that you would expect, you know, in business, for example.
It's funny because given how much money almost all Premier League teams will now spend on their analysis and scouting teams, if you're a chief executive and you're spending all this money on scouting, and then you're seeing your manager say, "No, don't worry about it. We're going to go play our natural game." You'd be tearing your hair out.
No, I mean, my view would be just stop them any way you can.
Yeah, exactly.
Back to Liverpool, this is something you kind of touched on earlier, Tony. How would you compare this Liverpool team to the 2013-14 team?
They don't have a genuine superstar like Suarez, who can, you know, sort of in the top three and the four in the world. They don't have that. I mean, Salah's great and he's had a massive impact, but he's not the sort of player who, you know, sort of will dominate a game, dominate the pace of a game, change the entire game itself.
Mm.
You know, when everything's going at 100 miles an hour and the ball's getting played in, he's going to be brilliant. But he's not that sort of player. I think I think the difference is Suarez. Suarez was, you know, just that year he was exceptional. And you would expect a player of that calibre and at that point in his career to drag a team to the title, and somehow they managed to... Somebody managed to slip up somewhere.
Do you think that this Liverpool team will be able to win the league under Klopp?
I think it's a very big ask at the moment. One of the things about Klopp, which gets me, is there's still a great sense of freshness about him, as if he's new. And like when we're coming up, well, you know, by the time the new season starts, we'll be on the verge of three years.
Yeah. A team cycle, almost three years, basically.
And, you know, there has been progression, and obviously making the quarterfinals of the Champions League this year is progression. Staying in the top four, yeah, that's brilliant. But at some point, there's got to be a bit more than that. He is getting the sort of players he wants. Unfortunately, City are moving ahead faster. United are going to spend like drunken sailors again this summer. I would expect that Arsenal, one way or another, will go on a splurge. Chelsea, God knows what happens there. So it's going to be difficult. I think starting off by winning a cup of some description would be...
Do you buy into this idea that... Liverpool are maybe, well, beyond City's quality, Liverpool are actually really well positioned to win the Champions League because of how good they usually can attack better sides?
Well, they can attack better sides well, but they concede a lot of goals against them. And I think we're going to find in the latter stages of the Champions League, teams with better compact structures who can defend at a much higher level than, I don't know, Brighton.
Yeah.
You can spank Brighton, but, you know, it's going to be a different thing. I mean, everyone looked at Juventus and those displays against Tottenham, and Tottenham are a good side.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Liverpool fans who go, oh, I wouldn't mind Juventus. I'm telling you, they're a difficult team to beat. They've got nous. Liverpool don't have a lot of nous.
Yeah, yeah.
They do the same things, and there's a lot to be said for knowledge and cynicism.
Yeah.
And where would you place this season in the context of the FSG ownership of the club? Does it feel like a kind of, like, progress is being made towards some kind of climax?
Oh, well, definitely progress being made. There wasn't a lot in the first five, six years. Finally, they've got the man. They love Klopp. Perhaps they overindulge him too much. You know, I'd ask harder questions of him at times. But certainly, they've done... The accounts are out today and they're all positive. So in that sense, everything's rosy. But at some point, it'll always come back to the Shankleyism. You know, Liverpool exists to win trophies. It'll come back to that and then people will be asking. The problem is, they've done a good job in the sense that they've made the club wash its face. They're not going to pump huge amounts of money into it. And there's stability there. But people are going to want more than that.
Mm.
How long do you think Klopp gets without bringing home some silverware?
I certainly think there's another couple of years. I think this time next year, if they're not achieving the same as they are now, people start asking questions. But I think if you get into a routine of top four, knockout stages of the Champions League, that Arsenal routine.
Yeah.
I think people will start demanding a little bit more.
How much do you think that is excused, though, by the fact that, well, ultimately City's super fortune, United, something close to it?
Well, I mean, the fact is, City have made a fair effort to comply with financial fair play.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone forgets that. United, again, they generate a great deal of revenue and spend. Liverpool should be able to spend the approximate amount. I mean, obviously not as much, but again, then you've got to target the right players. Recruitment has been a problem over the years. They've spent badly on. It hasn't so much been the money they've spent; it's been the players they've spent it on.
Yeah.
You know, the Markoviches and to a certain extent Emre Can, although some people love him. When they come in, they were supposed to be the replacements for Suarez, and don't worry, they're gonna like change the way the Premier League is played. Don't think so. So it's that sort of. Well, the biggest flaw with Fenway's whole tenure is being they thought they were cleverer than everyone else in football. That's been the biggest flaw. They're not bad owners. In fact, you could do a very, very much worse. But you know, less cleverness, more basic thinking.
Haven't the signings of Mane, Firmino and Salah been an indication that they are clever and they have been able to buy well?
Well, they bought in that department well, but look at the midfield, look at the defence. Mm. Until what? A matter of weeks ago, Mignolet was still in goal. And the first day he turned up at Melwood, everyone knew he was a wrong in the sense for Liverpool football.
Yeah. But maybe it's to do with, I think you hinted at this earlier, a stats-based approach to buying players is naturally, for quite obvious reasons, going to be better at identifying good attacking players and good defensive players.
Mm.
And that stats-based approach hasn't been able to find the right defensive players.
Well, one of the discussions I had again with a very senior person at the club, I said, I'm a big believer in stats. This, you know, sort of. Mm. Some people don't think so. I mean, I started my journalism career in the States and in American football, and I think stats are a brilliant tool. You've got to balance them, obviously. It's like football's poetry, not mathematics.
Mm.
You know, but poetry has a meter. It has a rhythm, a mathematical rhythm. You can do that. I said to a senior figure there, I said, the problem is when you can show me a stat for the use of space when the opposition have the ball,
Yeah.
Then I'll buy into the stats thing completely, because you can watch a game, and I've been there with loads of fans, you know, over the years, different players. I can remember Ronnie Whelan and Haman. And people, oh, he's done nothing all day. And what he'd done is he'd just go into an area where, you know, the opposition fullback looks down the line and there's Ronnie Whelan, and he thinks, oh, no, no. And he goes square and allows Rush to press, you know, and allows the team to push up the pitch.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and people would look at him and say, oh, what's he done? He hasn't run very far. He hasn't made many passes. Yeah. He scored no goals. And yet, his influence on the pattern of play was massive.
Yeah.
And that is my problem with it. And that is my problem with trying to grade defenders statistically. You know, you need to watch them, and you also need to take into account the characters. I mean, you know, it's all right getting Lovren, who looks great at Southampton, when he's got Schneiderlin in front of him directing
and a low pressure situation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you put him in front of the cop, and you've got the captain who's more worried about his game getting forward.
Yeah,
and he's in a different world, and he hasn't got the mentality to cope with.
Yeah,
what were Klopp's Borussia Dortmund team like defensively? Did they have these same problems?
Well, they're two title-winning seasons. They were, I think, they conceded something like 20 goals. I think there was one season they conceded fewer than 20 goals.
There is a high-profile European manager who is very dismissive of those two title wins and describes them as Germany was rubbish at the time. Yeah, I mean, but Bayern were doing nothing, which is a bit harsh, I think.
Very harsh. Yeah. But I also think, I mean, he had a recruitment department who got players in for him, didn't he? He's never.
Well, it was Mislintat, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they had protection in front of the defence, which goes back to what Tony was saying earlier, that they had Bender.
That Dortmund team had some. I remember being looking through the squad very early in, I think, the first season when they won it, and when they were kind of making waves. And had some kind of really senior figures that have been at the club for years, like the goalkeeper, Kel. And it's almost that nous that you spoke about.
Mm. Yeah.
So are those intangible factors that you were just describing in the context of Ronnie Whelan, are those the things which you think are most missing from this Liverpool side?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. Leadership. And personality. One of the things Fenway, when they first come in, they were very keen on is make Liverpool the go-to destination for Europe's young players. Mm. Up-and-coming young players could go and play and learn the trade there all together and go on to win things. Great idea. They found a load of young players in, and there was no leadership. They didn't know what to do when things went wrong. And the problem is, one of the problems they've had, is that as these players have grown and they've had no success, then they've looked abroad and thought, well, I'll go somewhere else. Only two ways that you keep players. One is paying the going rate and wages or winning things. And Liverpool don't quite do either.
I always thought of Ferguson was actually brilliant at that in terms of just bringing in the right character at the right time. I mean, because even in relation to that, like Chelsea have gone to a similar policy now where they've tried to ape Real Madrid and kind of sign those 21 to 24-year-olds so they have the next generation of stars and kind of even potentially on sales or whatever. But then it's left them kind of short of key areas. Whereas Ferguson kind of, I mean, in 01 even, he wanted Di Canio, despite his age, brought in Larsson in 06, 07. And he always had just knew that specific figure.
Sheringham, Van der Sar, Evra.
Ferguson was absolutely brilliant at signing like a 34-year-old who wasn't going to do much, but just added something intangible.
Yeah.
Even someone like Andy Gorham or Laurent Blanc or, you know, somebody like that to... I don't know, give people a kick up the arse, I don't know.
Yeah, and give them a little bit of benefit of the knowledge.
Yeah.
Completely. Tony, you've got a new book out. Can you tell us about it, please?
It's called Two Tribes. It's about the 1985-86 season, which was the year after Heysel, which football was at its lowest point in its history. Obviously being a major disaster at... In the European Cup final, 39 people died, and Liverpool fans were responsible, among other reasons. And this happened in the middle of a massive political battle in the United Kingdom, where the Thatcher government were trying to crack down on people they regard as the enemy within, the miners. Sort of most famously, the city of Liverpool, which was resisting through the so-called Militant Council, and set against this backdrop And football, Thatcher, immediately after Heysel, demanded that the FA withdraw the English clubs from Europe. And basically the contention of not only me, but Peter Reid and Neville Southall and various other characters, is that football was the biggest expression of working class culture. And it wasn't just about Heysel. It was an assault on working class culture. And against this backdrop, it's how football reinvigorated itself and basically started off on the path to the Premier League.
How did football reinvigorate itself?
Well, a couple of things. I think it was a fantastic year in terms of competition. Manchester United started the season off with a 10-game winning run, league winning run, went 15 games unbeaten. The headline said, give it to them now, and then they promptly fell apart. West Ham were magnificent. Frank McAvenny come down from Scotland. They weren't on television. Was banging in the goals, 18 before Christmas. He became the first anonymous superstar. You know, he's... what ITV's On the Ball took him across Waterloo Bridge, and were interviewing people. Say, oh, are you a West Ham fan? Yeah. What do you think, McAvenny? Oh, he's brilliant. He's superb. Would you like to meet him? And they didn't recognise me. Was that?
It was the treatment blackout, wasn't it?
Yeah, because one of the reasons is football at its worst point picked a fight with television. Good idea, and wasn't on the screens until the new year.
Can you tell us a bit about that fight and how that happened?
Well, the as usual. The likes of Ken Bates and the chairman around the league, Ron Nodes, Crystal Palace, the late Ron Nodes, they thought that the thing that would kill football is live television coverage. So they didn't want it on live.
They were right.
History has proven them, yeah.
Yeah. It's so anyway, when Bates acts like the proud father of the Premier League, and, yeah. look what I created. He tried to stop it. He tried to stop the monster growing a bit. And so, I mean, over frankly ridiculous sums of money, they basically said no to ITV and BBC, who were acting as a cartel.
Yeah.
So football was off the screens. But in that time, there was a lot of exciting stuff going on. And after Christmas, when the television came back, a brilliant title race developed between Everton, and who were the champions, and Liverpool under Kenny Dalglish in his first year as player-manager. And it's all, we all know what happened in the end. But it built up towards the FA Cup final at Wembley, Liverpool and Everton. So the most under scrutiny city in football, a year before had been involved in scouts involved in Heysel and the death of 39 people, were sort of beamed to the world, and everyone was waiting for it all to go wrong. Scouts couldn't behave themselves in large groups, and
the first chapter has that amazing story of when the football writers were called into Thatcher, and I think you quote Brian Glanville's account of it and his impression of Thatcher.
Oh yeah,
and the way she I suppose as you point out, it was almost her issue with everybody. She tried to distill everything into a black and white issue.
Oh, but it was Trumpian.
Yeah,
it's full of bluster and an obsession with fake news. There are so many parallels between it and today, and the political discords within the country.
Well, even on that, I mean, actually, when I was doing this piece 2 weeks ago on how kind of football has never been more influenced by geopolitics in terms of how many of the top clubs are directly owned by these kind of major kind of political powers now. It was influenced by politics in a different way, but almost to the same extent in your book. Like, it was on my mind as I was kind of researching the piece. I mean, and even throughout the book, the amount of kind of political undercurrents that are just unavoidable that you cannot discuss throughout all this.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, football is always a good indicator if you're taking the temperature, the political moods of a country. In this very divisive year, between 1984 and 1985, that period was the most violent and divisive year in my life that I've experienced. Not personally violent, one of them, but a lot of the same worrying sort of developments were occurring then. They're occurring.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But now,
why do you think Thatcher lost her battle against football? Would you put it that simply?
Did she lose?
Slaven Bilic claims that she only was on TV recently. Actually, yeah,
funny like foreign misconception that people have is that like Thatcher beat hooliganism in the UK rather than, I mean, Tony, you'll be able to speak about this better than me, but you'll be aware of that misconception, right?
Yeah, it's a complete misconception. So hooliganism was on the way. Heysel was a massive shock to everyone's system, coming after Birmingham, where Ian Hambridge was killed when a wall collapsed on the last day of the season against Leeds. And although it wasn't hooliganism, the Bradford fire shocked everyone. And I think everyone took a step back from the brink, even in that particularly violent year. I mean, you got to remember, not only was the miners striking, there was violence everywhere there. You know, every night we're getting beamed in from Northern Ireland into our living rooms. You know, street rioting. It was there was an atmosphere of, you know, down at Wapping. You know, that was the move to Wapping, the brutal
the times.
Yeah, extinguishing of the print unions. You know, and the scenes of anarchy on the picket lines, you know, were taking place. So it was a really divisive year. And what Thatcher did, she associated football with two things, with the sort of industrial action striking. One of the first things she said after Heysel, she said, these people, you know, sort of, I'm not surprised, you know, you look at the records and striking. Well, what's that got to do with it? You know, and she also associated it with being traitorous, to quote Alf Garnett, because she went to Hampden, didn't she, for a Scottish Cup final, and saw the Celtic ends where they were all flying tricolours, and said, why are they flying the flag of a foreign country? So she associated football fans with that. But what was an expression of working class culture that she wanted to destroy, and in a sense, that's happened.
And does actually, you point out the contradiction in the book, Dennis, but you know, when essentially, some of the worst for violence abroad were basically, you know, right-wing Tories. And I mean, with that kind of going into the race issue, I mean, the anecdote with John Barnes and the plane to Chile is incredible.
Yeah. I mean, you know, sort of the England fans who went abroad and caused so much trouble were classic Thatcherites.
Yeah.
You know, little Englanders. And you know, John Barnes is still rightly annoyed at the abuse he took from, you know, on a plane when he'd scored against Brazil. And, you know, and he was getting called the N-word on the plane, and none of the FA officials or none of the press actually said anything.
But what wasn't it? National Frontman was actually making sure he could hear, basically. It's only 1-0 because a goal by one of them doesn't count.
Exactly, And, you know, it was the year there was riots in... there was riots in Handsworth, there was riots in Brixton. You know, everyone talks about, you know, Cyril Regis died the other week, and the great Cyril Regis. Everyone's talking about 3 degrees, which has got racist undertones in itself, and I'm not having that. But, you know, that, like, right, Handsworth, and one of the things that's about in the book is that, you know, the three black players at West Brom, they developed just a matter of miles from Enoch Powell's constituency, a handful of miles, you know, five. He made the speech only a couple of miles away, the infamous Rivers of Blood speech, a couple of miles away. And then in 1985, Handsworth was burning. You know, so for all this, great 3 degrees and the cultural change, I'll tell you what, those boys were swimming against the tide.
Yeah.
How political were were the terraces in those, and how politicised did the average fan become as a result of what was happening, you know, externally?
Unfortunately, a lot of it was politicised in a sort of right-wing way. You know, there was lots of NF infiltration. They tried it in Liverpool in 78, and they got repulsed rather bloodily. For us, you know, we were very Liverpool. And Everton were very left-wing fan base, and were, you know, there was. I mean, I remember going to Wembley in 1984, during the miners' strike for the League Cup final, and I was really proud. You know, so I was on the train coming down, everyone was wearing red or blue "I support Liverpool City Council" badges and singing, you know, "Arthur Skirgle, we'll support you evermore." And the Londoners, they looked at us as if we were from another planet, a dirty, ugly, horrible planet. And you know what? We liked that because we were. We're from a planet where we believed that it was important to keep the framework of society and to keep the community. The funny thing is, the militant tendency and Thatcherism were two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
It was a revolt against one nation Tory patronage. And what both sides were saying is, the grammar school people in the Thatcherite thing, you know, the sort of lower... The middle class were saying, we want a slice of it. And what the militant tendency said, we want opportunity for everyone to go as far as we can. And they both wanted the same sort of thing, which was the end of that 1950s one nation Toryism. And both were radical in their own way. But the Thatcherites threw the baby out with the bathwater, with the "there is no society." And I know people say, she didn't mean "there is no society" in their actual interview she gave, because she goes on to qualify her. But that's the message she sent out to everyone.
30 years on, it's safe to say that, unlike back then, you can now argue that the state and capitalism are on the same side as football, rather than competing forces.
Hmm.
Would you say that the state has co-opted football, or that football has co-opted capitalism?
Oh... I think they've met in the middle. Yeah. That's the coward's answer. But they've met in the middle. But I think people, suddenly the realisation came that football could generate more income and more publicity than, say, the on-the-make local businessman, you know, ever dreamt of. Ken Bates again. get the lawyers. No. and I think once that realization come, the sanitization of the game. People think that Hillsborough was the major catalyst towards the Premier League. I contend it was Heysel.
Yeah.
I think the forces of history were heading that way after Heysel, and I think there became a realization that football could be a profitable business. It could be a sanitized business, and it could be a more positive reflection of English, in particular, culture worldwide than it had been.
Actually, how politicised do you think football itself was and footballers? Because it's a debate that's coming up now, I suppose, with especially around kind of Pep Guardiola and the ribbon, and even who footballers are willing to be employed by or take their money off. And there's absolutely no kind of, or there's very, very little dissent or kind of any sense of debate within football or from footballers. Has that changed much from then?
They were all soft Tories, really. They all voted Tory because they thought their income tax would be lower, which, you know, is the classic thing, isn't it? There were a few exceptions, you know, the likes of Peter Reid, you know, obviously he was from Eton. Harold Wilson had been their MP, and he was, you know, there was a couple of people at Liverpool. But most of them either didn't really care or were, you know, sort of vote Tory.
Yeah.
They had a great realisation, I think, the Liverpool and Everton players at the time, that given the beleaguered state of the city, that they were flag bearers for it. And that, I mean, at a time when Liverpool was, as a city, was under political, social and economic pressure, that they were the people who gave us an expression of our identity in a positive way. Mm. You know, it wasn't just all about strikes. We dominated Europe.
Civic pride.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a consciousness of that. But I don't think they were... they were very political in that sense. As ever, footballers, they go, they train. In those days, they drink. Now they go and play PlayStation. And they live in a bubble.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way it'll always be.
I think it shows how depoliticised footballers are nowadays, that Juan Mata's common goal campaign, which is an incredibly laudable thing from an obviously really great guy, but it's not a kind of like world-changing thing that he's doing, and yet it stands out so much, as do the other players like Chiellini who've got involved on his behalf, because it's now so unusual to see a footballer take that kind of stance.
Mm. Yeah, and also they've become even more, in one way, media savvy, people say, but in another way, bland. You know, for a footballer speaking out. I mean, you know, you look at James McCarthy and the Poppy thing,
McLean.
Someone's getting bullets in the post, and it's my fault. Sorry, sorry, James. You know, you look at that, and of course, the way the FA have tied themselves up in knots with the Guardiola thing. I think what's depoliticised football more and more is the link between the communities, certainly in the Premier League level. The communities and the clubs has been stretched to breaking point, and that has an awful lot to do with
it. So they don't have the kind of inherent connection that former players did. Mm. And even the money probably has a separate effect in that way too, I suppose. Now, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it comes back to the kind of the Michael Jordan line. You know, Republicans wear sneakers too. So in the sense that they've become such brands in and of themselves that there's that kind of prevailing view that if we say anything political, it could alienate what we sell, even if it's not directly by them, but people around them, and just the kind of the conditioned like that.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, on Michael Jordan, that position that he took in the 90s has, I think, now been a little bit undermined by the current generation of NBA stars like LeBron and Steph Curry actually being more political and more vocal than Michael Jordan could ever be. And he now looks slightly out of date.
Yeah. Out of place. And Tiger Woods, who basically refused to become the vanguard of any movement.
And you know, you look at the response to the anthem and taking the knee. You know, I think there's been a great awareness amongst American athletes of the political environment and the dangers it presents. And I think it's brilliant that they stand up. I'd love to see athletes being more politicised and speaking up more.
Yeah,
I mean, this comes down to, I think, financial motives, doesn't it? And this is essentially what globalization does. It creates a consensus around its own virtue that becomes almost impossible to challenge or even opt out of. This is kind of how globalization works, and I suppose explains why so few fans are ready to speak out against, you know, in any meaningful way against their own clubs, against, you know, the way that football is going. It doesn't, you know, globalization doesn't say we're gonna erode your democracy, we're going to sever the links between your club and its community. It says, look, here's Janino and Branco at your football club. Mm. You know, pray wonder at all these wonderful global gifts. And then by the time it's kind of seeped into your game, it's almost too late.
Yeah, yeah. And then you start aping that dumbass democracy, you know, my club right or wrong.
Yeah, I think what Johnny says is very much been the case amongst fans of Manchester City and Chelsea, who have said, I think I can say this on air, who have said embarrassingly little about the ownership of either Abramovich or Sheikh Mansour over the years, and have kind of get offended that it's been brought up recently, which is something that, I can say.
Chelsea fans with Abramovich are exactly the same. I don't put the Glazers on the same level. No. In the slightest, but people don't want to speak out about these things.
Well, I mean, we've seen another issues as well. You know, people are checking the decency at the turnstiles.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, and there is this. In terms of that, the kind of decency at the turnstiles. Again, this intense tribalism seems to take a kind of. It's obviously we don't see the violence of the 80s, but there's a much more kind of neurotic tribalism these days, I think. Now, obviously, kind of social media distills that, but it is it's interesting that.
Yeah, I think I've noticed that too. I think it's a function of people being able to identify as fans of their club endlessly, like 24/7. With every time you go on social media, you can be active as a fan of Club X.
Yeah.
In a way which you know, 30 years ago, you might go, you know, you could go to a game twice a week, you could buy a fanzine, you could buy a program, you could go to the game with your mates. But it's fewer like actions, if you know what I mean.
Well, the thing is, people consume the football in a different way these days. I mean, most of them get it through telly.
Yeah.
And, when you know, in 1985, 86, the year we're talking about in particular, the only way you could see for the first half of the season live football was go with the match.
Yeah.
In fact, for most of my lifetime, the only way you could see live football was go with the match. And it creates a different dynamic, a different experience. You know, I see people, on Twitter, you know, they charge you and they've got in the bio, like, you know...
Granite Jacket is a gooner.
Yeah, or, you know, I bleed red and white.
Yeah.
You know, and things like that. And you're like, really?
Yeah, and also, supporting a football team was never about kind of just forgetting about the football, because it's one thing I've thought, even in relation to the game on Saturday, you tweet an opinion about the game, and it feels like no one can take it as a football opinion in and of itself anymore. It's always, it's us against them. You've said that because you're biased. Well, no, it's just what I think about the football.
Yeah. Fans aren't any more passionate today than they were 30 years ago. I mean, you got diehard fans, you got people who did bleed red and white. They just didn't feel the need to inflect every single action they took in an average day with it.
Yeah, but the other thing is, when you used to have to go to the match, you go to the match, you'd watch it, you'd get beat, and you'd be pig sick. You know, what did you do? You went out for a drink with your mates, you know, and an hour later you'd be laughing. Now, in anger, you take to social media.
and that, I think, is connected to what you said earlier about Trent Alexander-Arnold apologising on Instagram because he played badly and Liverpool lost. Like, the idea that you can demand, you have a right to win, and you can demand that, and therefore by losing the players have let you down and have to apologise, is connected to that weird sense of entitlement.
Yeah, well, I remember I was there the day that Hansen had his nightmare there, and we got beat. You know, we didn't want to lynch Hansen. No one was slaughtering him. You know, we were a bit like, the kid didn't do very well, did he? You know, he's older than us. You know, he didn't do very well. You know, he's like, yeah, you know, don't think he's going to make it. And then it was gone, you know.
Yeah,
You moved on.
Well, and it's probably a bit rich for the media to be talking about this, but because of kind of social media and how instant everything is now, every defeat gets built up into a defining result. Even the same, I was thinking of it as well after the Spurs game on Wednesday, where, you know, this was supposedly a complete bottle job that said everything about the state of the club. Or it was just a defeat. Like, okay, they got some things wrong, but just lost to a very good team.
They were very good, and they just got beaten by a team with a little more experience, who's actually been to two of the previous three Champions League finals.
Yeah.
Coming back to expectations and grievances, how legitimate are the grievances of the West Ham United fans who went on the pitch on Saturday? And what does that tell us about ownership and fans today?
I would say entirely legitimate. I mean, there's so many. I was actually, I think we're doing a piece today on it, but if you're to list the number of problems at that club right now, it's actually, and the number of legitimate complaints, it's with obviously the main one now being this kind of botched move to the stadium, everything around it, and the running of the team. I mean, it's just, it goes on and on. Actually, I'm just sorry to cut across, but Tony wants to get in there, but West Ham were given the chance to condemn some of the issues that happened last week and didn't. And I think one of the reasons was they didn't want to inflame the situation. Well,
I thought it was a great piece on the West Ham, you know, sort of the problems from the right-wing groups and the ICF. funny. that's a different subject. But yes, I am laughing at them. It was a great piece. But I think West Ham's owners could go away with it all had they stayed in Upton Park. I think the biggest issue of it all is that move into a crushingly unsuitable stadium, chasing cash and chasing this idea that they were going to make the step to become a global powerhouse club, rebranding the badge. And when they moved from Upton Park, they left the soul there. And West Ham, I mean, sadly, have run on soul for years.
Yeah. I mean, even in that, I suppose, to be honest, I was one of those ones initially kind of convinced of the stadium move, because I thought there is an opportunity for someone to be a global London club, because it's such an advantage to be based in London.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I do wonder, I mean, I was actually talking to Ken Early yesterday. He was kind of making the point that, I mean, to be that global kind of London club and gather all these kind of floating kind of tourists and all that, you need to have some sort of international status. And Ireland's always kind of almost been the first kind of the first staging post for that with the English league. Yet, basically, we were saying how West Ham, despite being one of England's maybe 10, 12 biggest clubs, in Ireland they're actually not that well supported. Well, they don't know.
Claret and Blue up Black and Tan.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're associated with a certain kind of Englishness.
So they're
not going to pick up.
But that's it. And at the core of the club isn't the possibility of more support elsewhere. The core of the club is actually, it's almost like one of the most distinctive and idiosyncratic fan bases in the Premier League.
Yeah, it is.
Well, it is. And the mad thing is, the East End was built on immigrants.
Yeah.
You know, the anti-Semitic thing and all that. The East End was full of immigrants from Eastern Europe, full of Irish.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's full of, you know, people from the subcontinent. They should be trying to embrace that.
Mm.
Yeah. I find it very ironic that these guys, troublemakers, are calling themselves ultras. It's a very European term for a far-right group.
Well, they love Lazio. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's funny, it kind of speaks to what we were talking about earlier in the sense that they were, in chasing global profile and ultimately money by putting London in their badge and everything, they've managed to basically disconnect themselves from their local fan base and local kind of community which gave them support, and they've basically fallen between two stools.
Yeah, yeah.
So they haven't got the global profile, nobody wants to play for them, nobody wants to manage them, they've got David Moyes as manager, they'll probably be in the Championship next season, and all their fans hate them,
but when Golden Sullivan came in, they kind of played up the fact that we're East End boys, we're locals, and this is almost a return to our roots. Mm. And the lesson here really, I suppose, is that it's so much more important who your what your owners do than who they are.
Mm. Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah, it's almost an example of how the free pass given to the English owner, which has always been. I mean, it's very easy to get it's very easy to get nostalgic about a golden age of English ownership, which never existed. Like owners have been destroying football. Have been destroying football clubs in England for. I don't know, 150 years now. Like, there's nothing new about this, but obviously, having that kind of local authority, that local credit, seems to buy you a bit of extra time.
Well, the mad thing is as well, they're all chanting, sack the boards. Well, how are you going to sack the owners for one? And we want someone to come in and buy the club. Well, there's not many people in the market for football clubs. You know, Mike Ashley wants to sell the club.
Yeah.
He said he'll sell the club. No sign of that happening. At Sunderland, Ellis Short, I'll give it away. People who've looked at the books have gone, nah, no thanks.
Does that point to a potential problem for football, maybe, especially with this kind of undercurrent of that's always been there, of a Super League, that owners want the flashy big clubs now, but everyone else now is increasingly getting left behind.
Well, yeah, when they moved to the Olympic Stadium and they changed the badge, they thought they were going to turn themselves into one of the flashy big clubs.
Yeah.
And it doesn't quite work that way.
They will be one of the biggest and flashiest clubs in the Championship, no doubt.
I think Moyes will save them.
Do you,
Yeah.
My instinctive sense, having seen Saturday, and I wasn't there, but it's just, I don't think they can recover from it. I don't think they have the right ingredients in the dressing room or Moyes or the boardroom or anywhere at the club. I think it's so.
Well, three goal defeats in a row.
It's gone south for them at just the wrong time. There is just enough time. What was it? Nine, 10 games left.
Yeah,
enough time for them to turn
and
around.
The only thing that I think will save them is people in worse states in that league. They're queuing up to go down.
Yeah. Who's going? Actually, we've got Southampton. Probably no goals.
Yeah,
West Brom.
West Brom are gone, aren't they?
Yeah.
Huddersfield can't beat 10-man Swansea, 78 minutes. Couldn't score a goal.
Crystal Palace.
Jesus, it's a bad league.
They are queuing up.
Yeah. So that'll save West Ham.
Yeah.
On that optimistic note, we're going to draw the podcast to a close by awarding our free Sevilla shirt to one of our lucky winners. The Sevilla shirt was provided by our friends at New Balance. The winner is Joe Arditi, the username Berbatov Boy, who left a very nice review of our podcast on iTunes, which goes to show that if you're nice about us, we'll give you things. thank you very much to Joe. We will be sending you the shirt.
Get in touch, isn't it?
We'll get in touch with you.
Sounds vaguely threatening.
Yeah.
We know where you live, Joe. We know.
Thanks very much for listening. Thank you, Miguel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks very much for listening. Please leave us a nice review on iTunes, and we'll see you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.